From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. 40 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. At 6:01 p.m. in Memphis, one of King's aides, Ralph Abernathy, heard what sounded like a firecracker. Abernathy opened the door to his room at the Lorraine Motel and found Dr. King lying across the balcony. The sound he'd heard seconds earlier was the gunshot that struck Dr. King in the neck. Top aide Andrew Young was in the parking lot with other members of the King entourage.
When I looked up, he was no longer on the balcony, but I could see his shoes sticking out from under the banister there. And I ran up, and there he was. He was obviously gone.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report. Here is Don Hickman in Memphis.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot outside of Memphis.
Dr. King was officially pronounced dead at 7:05 p.m. As the news trickled out via television, radio, and word of mouth, it left sorrow and anger in its wake. We asked a series of African-American luminaries from the worlds of politics and letters, what do you remember about the moment you heard Dr. King had died?
I will never forget the day Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Donna Brazile was 8 years old at the time, living just outside New Orleans.
It was a Thursday, a cloudy day in New Orleans. I just returned home from school, finished my homework. My grandmother, Frances, who at the time was 71 years old, was in the kitchen, and she called us. And we went into her room, and she said, "I need you all to pray." And I didn't know what happened because she was in the kitchen stirring something up. And the next thing I knew, we were on our knees. And I kept looking up at my grandmother. She was crying, and I kept saying, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Martin Luther King had been shot."
That year, Roger Wilkins was Assistant Attorney General under Ramsey Clark.
The agency I ran, Martin had said, was the wing of the civil rights movement inside the government.
On the evening of April 4th, Wilkins was in Washington, D.C. meeting with civil rights lawyer Marion Wright. They were discussing programs for the poor in Mississippi when Wright's fiancé, Peter Edelman, called on the telephone.
He told Marion that Dr. King had been killed. I talked to my wife, and she said, "Yes, the Attorney General was looking for me." And I talked to the Attorney General, and he said, "Come in to the office, please."
I heard the news over radio. I didn't own a television at that time.
In 1968, poet Haki Madhubuti was known by his birth name, Don L. Lee. He was 26, living in a basement apartment on the west side of Chicago, and completely immersed in the more militant ideas of the Black Power movement.
You know, just like everyone else, I was stunned, and even tears came to my eyes, because even though philosophically I was not totally in the nonviolent movement, it must be made clear that when he was here in Chicago, I participated in all the marches, all of them. And so whatever philosophical problems I had with him were eclipsed as a result of his actions here in Chicago.
Dan Rather, reporting for CBS News.
I was sitting in front of the television watching the regular program when the newsman interrupted.
Author and theologian Michael Eric Dyson was 9 years old and growing up in Detroit.
And in a kind of somber monotone announced that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot in Memphis, Tennessee. And behind me, my father ejaculated this, you know, as if someone had punched him in the gut, an involuntary verbal response that testified to the magnitude of that news.
We finished our prayers and went sat by the television and waited to hear more news. It was probably nightfall before we learned that he had not survived.
It's been just a little over an hour since Dr. Martin Luther King died from an
Again, Ambassador killed. Andrew Young.
I knew enough biology to know that he probably didn't even hear the shot. I guess my first thought was that if anybody deserved a heavenly reward, he certainly deserved it. But then I got frustrated and angry because how were we going to make it? We were just barely making it with him, and he's gone on to heaven and leaving us in this hell. We almost all would wish we could have gone with him and gotten it over with.
in the evening of Dr. King's murder, the Attorney General's office filled up.
Roger Wilkins.
What we were getting from the field was that there was beginning to be serious unrest in some of the cities, and there was already some burning.
I walked outside of my, you know, basement apartment, just walked and saw people in the community all saying, King was shot, King was shot.
Now we are ready to start. We're going to finish it up.
Then that evening, fires began to hit Chicago.
Crowds have been gathering on street corners and police are trying to break them up.
Riots sprang up in more than 100 cities across America. President Lyndon Johnson went on national television.
I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
But King was our voice. You see, so when you killed him, you killed a little bit of us. And the only way we could respond in terms of this rage was to hit the streets. I hit the streets as an organizer trying to stop some of this stuff, but at the same time, I'm not a fool, you see. You're going to allow people to do what they feel is necessary and just get out of the way.
Well, I thought that it was a great betrayal of Martin Luther King.
In Memphis, King's lieutenants attempted to go on television to plead for calm.
But they were more interested in covering the fire than they were in hearing what we had to say.
What we were hearing from some of the preachers and some of the leaders in the community was that some cities were burning across the country, and they said, we have to put something black across our front door to show solidarity with the civil rights movement. We were afraid that if we didn't put something on the window or the door sill, that perhaps our home would get burned. And of course, my mother didn't want us to do anything, but I went and grabbed her headscarf and went around the back of the house through the alley with a thumbtack, and I put it across our front door in solidarity.
Police put out a wanted bulletin for, quote, a young white male.
Back in Washington, President Johnson ordered Attorney General Ramsey Clark to go to Memphis. Roger Wilkins was part of the delegation.
Plus a man named Deke DeLoach, who was the third-ranking person in the FBI. And DeLoach then was full of information, I put that in quotes, about where the FBI search was. He said that they had the rifle upstairs in the FBI laboratory, that this was a lone gunman. It was not the result of a conspiracy, a lone gunman who would soon be under arrest. I am not sure that any of us were thinking very straight. We had absorbed a terrible shock. We had very little sleep, and we had no verifiable sources on the ground to give us information that contradicted that of the FBI. And I think general human impulse was to believe your FBI, which was a mistake. I should have been more careful. I should have been more suspicious of the FBI. I was not.
We saw all of the policemen running toward us with their guns drawn when the shot obviously came from behind them. But the first implication that there was some government involvement was that there was a big 6-8 foot, azalea bush or some kind of big bush right there across the street from the hotel. And some people thought they saw a shot coming from, they saw smoke coming from that bush. But by the time we got up the next morning, in fact, even when we got back from the hospital late that night, the Memphis Parks Department had gone out there in the middle of the night and had cut down all of those bushes and swept that area clean. Now, when we asked about that, they said that was by order of the Memphis police. And so that was the first signal that there was something wrong.
I'm a poet. It sent me to the page. And so I did write a poem about it, Assassination. It was wild. The bullet hit high, the throat neck. And from everywhere, the motel, from under bushes and cars, from around corners and cross streets, out of the garbage cans and from rat holes in the earth, they came running. With guns drawn, they came running toward the king, all of them, fast and sure, as if the king was going to fire back. They came running, fast and sure, in the wrong direction.
Dr. King had come to Memphis to support striking sanitation workers. The day after his murder, the workers decided to proceed with their scheduled march. Roger Wilkins was there.
It was the most moving demonstration ever seen. These black men wearing sandwich boards, each side of which said, "I am a man." It brought back feelings about slavery and about the worst times of Jim Crow. To see that the day after Dr. King's murder was one of the most moving things I've ever seen in my life.
The speech that Dr. King had given the day before his assassination was heard across the airwaves.
And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you.
I, on the other hand, had no idea who Martin Luther King Jr. was, had never heard his name, had never heard his voice, had never seen his face. And then immediately I was ushered into the last speech that Dr. King gave.
So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
And that was my introduction on television to this great prophet of American democracy. And after that, I went out and found every book I could of Martin Luther King Jr., every speech I could get.
That moment in my life, I wanted to work in the movement. I wanted to be a civil rights worker. I was totally not only in love with the movement, but I saw myself as a little girl taking my own seat at the table.
Lives transformed by the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We heard, in order of their first remarks, Ambassador Andrew Young, Democratic political strategist Donna Brazile, former Assistant Attorney General Roger Wilkins, poet and educator Haki Madhubuti, and theologian Michael Eric Dyson. And you can go to our website, nprnewsandnotes.org, for more commentaries, photos, and reporting on King's life. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The rallying cry in the election is change, and we're not talking about Obama or America. We're talking about Africa and the election in Zimbabwe. Voters in the Southern African nation are anxiously waiting to hear if their presidential election will bring a sea change in leadership. President Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party have ruled for 28 years, since winning a war over colonial leaders. But ZANU-PF lost control of parliament in last Saturday's election. The government hasn't released the results in the presidential election yet, leading some locals and international observers to question whether the vote tallies are being rigged. Opposition party the Movement for Democratic Change says it won the presidential race outright, and its candidate, Morgan Tsvangirai, should be president. Yesterday, reports came in saying police raided the opposition party's headquarters. The police also detained some foreign journalists, including a New York Times correspondent. I recently spoke with Precious Shumba. He's the secretary of Zimbabwe Journalists for Human Rights. I asked him to describe the mood in the capital city, Harare.
Not many people are talking openly. Policemen armed and in riot gear, almost in every corner. They are not attacking people, but people want the results. They want to know who the president is. They are very clear that Mugabe must go.
I also asked Professor Shumba if President Mugabe would have to leave Zimbabwe if he loses the election.
If Mugabe loses, as is widely expected, he will have to negotiate on almost every facet of his life. So the issue of whether he will stay here in Zimbabwe or elsewhere entirely depends on the new administration, probably led by the opposition.
Finally, I asked Precious, who lives in the poor urban heart of the capital city, why he chooses to stay in the country, and if he ever questions being a journalist in Zimbabwe, where his career is risky and sometimes dangerous.
It would be an act of cowardice if I were to say I ceased to be a journalist. I feel I'm accountable. I need to contribute to public discourse. So I'm not really intimidated or really afraid of what might happen to me.
Precious went on to say he feels it's his obligation to continue the work that other journalists and human rights activists had started. Again, that was Secretary of Zimbabwe Journalist for Human Rights, Precious Shumba. He spoke with us by phone from Harare, Zimbabwe. And for more on the news out of Zimbabwe, we turn to our reporters' roundtable. With us, Kevin Merida, Associate Editor of The Washington Post. He's also editor of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Derek McGinty, news anchor at WUSA 9 in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's keep going with Zimbabwe first. By law, the Electoral Commission is supposed to release results within 6 days of voting. That means today. So the ruling party, and this is evolving very quickly, is calling for a runoff, which should happen if no candidate won more than 50% of the vote. But they're not actually releasing the results of the vote. So let me start with you, Kevin. How do you think the coverage of this election will and should unfold from here? And will the media attention internationally shape the fairness or unfairness of this process?
Well, you're continuing to get more of a focus on the media coverage. And I think because, you know, Robert Mugabe is such a large figure in Africa. I mean, he's one of the figures that people recognize. And I hate to draw these parallels to Idi Amin and Mobutu Sese Seko and others who have gone, but I think that he's kind of one of the last towering figures. You know, you see that much of Africa has moved toward democratic government more and more, and that's been very difficult. And a lot of times it has taken really these crisis moments to really focus world attention on some of the troubling electoral problems. You saw the same thing that happened in Kenya. So, you know, I think it is going to kind of work against the Mugabe ruling party, and I think the spotlight will continue to shine brightly.
Corey, again, this story is evolving, but ZANU-PF, the ruling party, now says that the opposition party bribed electoral officials. It's contesting 16 parliamentary seats. That would be enough to give ZANU-PF the majority again, which apparently it had lost. So, if there's allegations of vote rigging on either side, do you think the international community is going to step in on this one? And you know, putting this in the context of this being an African nation which fought its way to liberation, but then slipped into what appears to be a dictatorship, where do you think the international community is going to line up on this one?
Well, I think that the international community from a distance would certainly advocate free and fair and open elections and a lawful exchange transition of power if it comes to that. I think what it will take is an honest broker in the form of, say, for example, Jimmy Carter or other humanitarians who have made it their business to go in and try to be an honest broker when it comes to elections. I think the role of news media there can also play a part. International media can try, at least, to play a role in reporting this in the best way possible so that you do shine a light on the process. To the extent that you can shine a light on the process, that's the extent, that may be the extent to which you get international intervention.
And Derek, the journalists are now becoming part of the story. We just heard from Precious Shumba. He's a local journalist, and it's risky for him to do his job. But also, some of the international journalists have been taken into custody for allegedly violating the country's journalism laws. One of them is Barry Barak, a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times. When you're dealing with a government that doesn't want international reporters, you know, how should journalists make a decision? You know, okay, well, maybe it's illegal for me to report, but I have to do it anyway. Is that something that, that journalists need to just say?
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, you heard from your friend Precious Shumba that, you know, it was an act of cowardice if he were to leave his country. And I think, look, a couple of things. First of all, in the age of the internet, it's very difficult to do what leaders like Mugabe have done over the years, which is quash the press just by sheer force of will and law and use the armed forces to make sure that the news doesn't get out. I mean, it's almost impossible to do it that way anymore because the news is ubiquitous and the internet is ubiquitous. But I think the key thing we should watch here is what we seem to see is a sort of a push and pull within the Mugabe administration such that it is. I mean, you heard from some that there's some negotiations going on with generals as to how he would leave. On the other end, you have hardliners who say he absolutely is not leaving. He's going to stay in power. This man is 84 years old. So time itself is going to take him out of power before too long. You have to wonder how much of the resistance comes from those who benefit from his regime being in power as much as it comes from himself.
Kevin, what significance does this story have in the U.S.? And I mean, I say that with, you know, all due respect, Americans may not always be the most plugged into international events, but this has a lot of different elements. There's race, there's colonialism, there's, you know, power, all of these things that make stories sexy. What interest do you think Americans have in an election like this?
Well, I think regrettably, there's not the high level of interest. I mean, I think that, you know, we have had a very narrow focus when it comes to African coverage from a U.S. perspective. I think that, you know, you see a lot of coverage when there are a conflict, like in Somalia, or when, particularly when there's U.S. involvement. But we've missed some big stories. I mean, it took, you know, relate to famine. Some of the famine stories in Ethiopia and the Sudan, we were late coming to the Rwandan crisis and genocide. And I think that our attention as Americans tends to be focused on, you know, the kind of desperation of the people that's exhibited when you see, you know, famine and genocide, but I think less so in political crisis.
Well, Kevin, can I, this is Derek McKinney, just ask a quick question. I mean, wouldn't you say there's some level of, I don't want to call it strongman fatigue? I mean, you pointed out that Mugabe's sort of the last of the African strongmen, and Americans may feel like we've heard this story before. He's either going to stay in or he's not. How does it affect me? I mean, these are the kind of issues you have to deal with as a newspaper man, aren't they?
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, and we have gotten involved in some of these conflicts, not to draw a parallel, but in the case with Aristide. I mean, you know, we got involved in that. First he's in our country, then he's back over in Haiti. And there's always a sense that it's someone else's problem, that the U.S. Doesn't need to be involved in the internal politics, and particularly I think of black nations. I think there's much less interest. If this were happening in some other places, I think there would be more interest.
I want to transition us to the biggest story in the U.S. today, which is the 40th anniversary of the death of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Corey, how do you feel? What was the highlight for you this week in terms of coverage, you know, either by your organization or anyone else of this momentous anniversary?
Well, Farai, I'm here in Atlanta, so the coverage is continuing. And this is obviously home base for the King family, for Martin Luther King, and certainly the civil rights movement. So that continues. I would say that so far, what struck me personally was an editorial that Kevin's own newspaper ran earlier this week that was an excerpt from an editorial run 2 days after King was assassinated. And it talked about, it looked forward and it was rather prophetic. It talked about the fact that blacks looting and rioting after his death can more easily be forgiven for that than can whites. Because whites have either been actively or passively involved in the discrimination of blacks since slavery. And so moving forward, even once whites become, quote unquote, honest, you know, sort of fair and honest brokers and dealers with African Americans, they will be on a certain type of probation for many, many years. And I think that what's interesting about that is that has been the case. And I don't know that our public consciousness has really kept that in discourse. But I think going forward here in Atlanta, it's very interesting. I think every news organization, certainly in this area, the churches, the entire community here are pulling out the stops in more creative ways. You're seeing, you know, the testimonials like you had on the earlier part of the show. And also I went to a screening last night of a new documentary on King that was narrated by Tom Brokaw. And I think that given given that race has been kind of brought back into the public discourse by the Democratic presidential race, the nomination phase of it, I think certainly here in Atlanta there is a greater sensitivity by all, black, white, no matter what your race is, to the issue of race. And I think I'm seeing kind of a higher absorption rate of the seriousness of where the country is as a result of this anniversary date.
Kevin, Corey just brought up the presidential race. Of course, Barack Obama, a lot of people have been saying that he is in some ways the fruit of the bitter times the Reverend King death marked. Do you see it that way? Do you see us turning a corner in America?
Well, certainly Barack Obama is really the first African leader, certainly politician, embraced so widely by so many different people on a national scale. And I think that speaks to a certain extraordinary progress, but it also speaks to some of his own gifts. And I think when you're looking at Dr. King, we look at him, you know, kind of in the rearview mirror. And in that sense, King looks really amazing. At the time, he was under siege. He was unpopular. He battled for a lot of unpopular causes, including the Vietnam War and the upliftment of poor people. And he got a lot of flack. He was, the Black Power movement either embraced it or repudiated. And he was living in dangerous times. And so I think that, if you look at what he was able to achieve, and then you transfer to the times now with Barack Obama, and you've seen some of the same parallels. I mean, he's walking a very difficult line. He gets under fire because of what his minister, Jeremiah Wright, said. If you were to go back and review some of the speeches that Dr. King had, you would see some of the same fiery, tough rhetoric, harshness against government that was exhibited in Wright's speeches. So I see a lot of interesting parallels from those times to the times we have today.
And Derek, what about, you know, just the basics, money? You know, Dr. King ended his life on this note of trying to deal with poverty. And today we hear some really disturbing statistics about black economics. I mean, how much have things changed?
Well, you know, there was an interesting editorial. You mentioned editorial in the Washington Post. There was a piece by Eugene Robinson in the paper today basically saying that you got to really look at how much has really changed since then. That while at the time, 40% of African Americans were poor. Now, just 20% are poor, but they are more entrenched in poverty than they were then. I mean, so many are more middle class. So many more make $100,000 than did in 1968 or whatever. But those that are left, it seems, are much more hopeless. And we see the fruit of that in the violence and the struggle that goes on every day that seems so much more intractable and difficult to solve than it was maybe 40 years ago.
Any final thoughts briefly, Derek?
Well, you know, on the King situation, I just want to bring this up. First of all, the man was so brilliant. And I think that's the thing that has been left out of the conversation about Dr. King. If you go back and read what he wrote, if you read the letter from the Birmingham jail, even if you read some of his later speeches on the Vietnam War and on the things that, as was just mentioned, made him somewhat unpopular at the time, his intelligence, I think sheer genius shines through. And we just don't talk about that so much. You know, he had a doctorate. He had a degree from very competitive universities at the time, which almost, you know, very few African-Americans had done. I mean, he was an amazing man. And I don't want to in any way set aside his moral compass. But the man's sheer genius is something that doesn't get enough discussion as far as I'm concerned.
I think Derek is exactly right. I mean, if you realize that he was doing this in a time when his life was under constant danger, threats, and he was able to fuse so many different issues. I think part of it was because he had a social consciousness that was grounded in theology, in the social gospel.
We're going to have to leave it there. So glad you could join us, gentlemen. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We've been speaking with Kevin Merida, associate editor of The Washington Post and editor of Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. He joined us from The Washington Post studios. Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. And Derek McGinty, news anchor for WUSA in Washington, D.C. He was at the NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Earlier in the show, we looked back at the assassination of Martin Luther King. He was killed 40 years ago today. But joining me now with a different take on 1968 is NPR's Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, it is true. 1968 was a grim year for America. Not only was it the year King was killed, but Senator Bobby Kennedy was also gunned down in 68. And by June, thousands of Americans had been killed in the Vietnam War, and the protests against that war were turning deadly. But 68 wasn't all bad news. Lots of folks were just coming into the world at that time. That year, more than 3.5 million people were born in the U.S. alone. The civil rights movement was being eclipsed by black power, just as the 68 babies were learning to walk. So we wanted to know what life's been like for blacks who were born during that turbulent year. And we found a couple of folks who are celebrating their big 4-0 this year. Susan Champion is a soon-to-be law student living in Seattle, Washington. She'll have her big party on August 13th. Happy birthday coming up early for you. And Lynette Brooks is a mother and homemaker here in Los Angeles. She was born on April 2nd, 1968, just 2 days before King's assassination. Lynette and Susan, welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Let's begin with this. Our year of birth is something that stays with us our entire lives, but it means different things to different people. Now, because of the historic nature of the year of your birth, 1968, does it carry any special meaning to you to have been born in that turbulent year? For example, Lynette, you were born just as a national crisis was looming over the killing of King.
You know, it's interesting. I was just speaking with my mother and just reminiscing about my birth. And some of the things that we talked about, she was like, you know, I didn't even realize, even though I knew King was assassinated, she said, but when you were born, I was busy raising you. I didn't even have time to mourn Dr. King's death. And to be born during that time, I mean, just to think about such a magnificent man who was really cut down in the prime of his life. It's just so heartbreaking just to think that he could still be doing major contributions to the African-American community now.
If he was still living,
yeah.
Well, Susan, what about you? Do the significant events of that year, like King's assassination or Robert Kennedy's assassination, do they have any special relevance for you?
Well, I've always kind of felt incredibly special to have been born at that time. I mean, it was so turbulent, and I've always carried with me kind of the sense that with that turbulence and with that violence, you know, was spawned a completely new era of change in a different way. And, I feel like I was very lucky to have been born at that time because, you know, my parents were very committed to social justice, and a lot of that came out of the King tradition and what he taught us and how he taught us to conduct our lives. So I've always felt really, really blessed to have been born at that time.
Well, how do your peers, for both of you, you know, the ones you know who were also born in 1968, how do they view themselves in light of when they were born? In fact, Lynette, do you even ever discuss that?
You know, unfortunately, we don't, which is so sad. I think we're so caught up in what's going on now today that we don't really reminisce and think about what transpired back when, as far as all the things that King has done for us thus far. And it's just really sad that we were so worried about the clothes that we wear and the things that we drive and not really concentrate on just the wonderful things that Dr. King possessed and really showed us how to move about as a community now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just unfortunate.
You know, Susan, you went to 4 different high schools, I understand it, in 4 very different parts of the country before you graduated. How did all of that bouncing around impact the way that you experienced race as a teenager?
Well, you know, I was actually, it seems like a good thing now, but at the time it was definitely challenging to be the new girl every year at school, and in at least half of them to be the only person of color in the school. I went to school in Chicago, which was a very, very diverse environment, and I went to Connecticut from there, where I felt there was more sort of segregation. While there was diversity, there was a much clearer line between blacks and whites, and it was almost as if you had to choose. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went to Pennsylvania, to Allentown, where I was truly the only person of color in my school. And I feel like I was very, very lucky to have seen how differently race was addressed in these different parts of the country. And it's really given me a broad sense of just how far we've come, but also how far behind we are, mm-hmm. and how little understanding there can be in some places. So I feel really lucky to have had that.
You know, I know that in your case, Lynette, that you grew up in Los Angeles, went to an integrated high school,
yes.
but you graduated from an historically black college.
Yes.
How did being born when you were born, do you think, influence your view of race and yourself?
Well, I know that just growing up, my mom and dad wanted to make sure that I had everything that was afforded to me and my sister. And that means if going to an interracial-based school, that was what was important to them. And I really thought that just really being able to assimilate and to kind of join with others during that time, I didn't really see race per se. I didn't have any – there was no major effect on me at that time. But I did know that when I graduated from high school that I knew I wanted to attend a black college. And that was a goal of mine because a lot of the classes that I were in, I would have been maybe one or two minorities in the class. So I just felt a desire to go to a black college and really to experience that life there.
1968, 40 years ago.
40 years.
This is great. I'm going to bring it to a close with this question. In addition to having been born in such an important year, 2008 is also an important year in both your lives. Lynette, you just turned 40 3 days ago. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
And Susan, you'll be celebrating your 40th this summer. There's even a new television show now about turning 40. So here's my question to both of you. Is 40 the new 30?
Oh, most definitely.
Absolutely.
I don't feel any different. I don't feel any different. I'm just enjoying life, enjoying being with my family, with my little kids, with my husband. I'm having a great time.
And Susan?
Well, I'm actually here at New Student Admit Day at Berkeley, so I'm surrounded by, you know, people who are just out of college, and of course I'm, you know, about 15 years out of college, and I certainly don't feel a huge gap. I mean, I feel like I'm raring ready to go and absolutely ready to start a whole new phase of my life, so...
Wow. Definitely. 1968, one hell of a year. Susan Champion is a soon-to-be law school student living in Seattle, Washington. Lynette Brooks, a homemaker living right here in Los Angeles. Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. You're welcome. Have a great day.
Have an awesome day.
That was NPR's Tony Cox. When Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was killed in 1968, Michael Eric Dyson was in grade school. Like so many people, he was taught to revere King's courage and sacrifice. Now, 40 years after King's assassination, Dyson is asking how well subsequent leaders have responded to the void left by King. How should African-American progress be measured all these years later? Dyson has put his musings in a new book. It's called April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Farai.
So you write about an incident at the 1962 convention of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It's about 6 years before Reverend King's assassination. Now, he's addressing the convention when he's brutally attacked by a young neo-Nazi. After the man's restrained, King tells his followers, "If I am stopped, this movement will not stop. If anything happens to me, there will be others to take my place." What does that statement by him mean to you?
Well, I think that Dr. King was trying to reinforce the troops, so to speak, who were fighting in the trenches of racial warfare, to believe that the movement was bigger than any man or any woman, or any individual, that there was a collective will of the people being exercised through their individual talents, gifts, and sensibilities, but that the movement couldn't be trumped, that his death would only strengthen the movement, that the death of any other figure would in no way diminish the greatness of the cause for which they were willing to die. He was willing to die for his people. He struggled back and forth with that death and what it might mean. But he was signaling to the rest of them that, you know, he wasn't an egomaniac. He wasn't a guy who was trying to say, I want to be the Messiah, even though people had made him that way. And then thirdly, I think what it was suggesting, Farai, is that the cause in which we are invested will, in many cases, cause people to suffer, and that we shouldn't lie to people about the nature of that suffering, but that that suffering could ultimately be redemptive. Martin Luther King Jr., after all, was quite famous for telling black folk constantly that the black blood that would be shed could indeed redeem the nation.
Now, you bring up a term, automortology, and you talk about the ways in which Dr. King essentially gave his own eulogy, not just once, but several times. Tell us why that was important to him.
Well, it was important to him because he wanted to shape the subsequent perception of his death after it would occur. That's a weird term. I talk about automortology as a kind of autobiographical statement through death, through anticipating one's death. And then the tense in which it would occur, I call it the future moral anterior, looking back on what will have been and what should have been. And King wanted to shape how his death would be seen. The only revenge he could take as a Christian minister was to take vengeance on those who would murder him through an ethic of Christian love by shaping in advance of his death what the story should be after he died. So, for instance, he said in a sermon at Ebenezer Baptist Church, if any of you are around when I have to meet my day, I don't want a long funeral. If you get somebody to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long. Tell them not to mention I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That isn't important. Tell them not to mention I have 300 or 400 awards. That's not important. Tell them not to mention where I went to school. I want you to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody, to be right on the war question, and to feed the hungry and the like. So he was taking advantage of the rhetorical outposts that had been developed within the civil rights movement for him. He was the most prominent and visible exponent of civil rights in America. And he used that bully pulpit to tell the truth about social suffering and the vulnerable, but also to shape the subsequent interpretation of his life and the meaning of it. And I think it was quite ingenious and also made necessary by the fact that he was faced with death so often. Here was a man, after all, Farai, who ate, slept, and drank death. He was threatened literally every day of his life. And despite those threats, he got up in pulpits across the nation to preach the fear from his breast, so to speak, because he also was fearful in many ways. But he kept overcoming that fear by delving more deeply into the cause for which he was willing to die.
Now, you go into leadership in this book in terms of, you know, the phrase, the much reviled and justifiably reviled phrase, black leaders, and the ways in which different people have been seen both from within the community and outside the community as leaders for an entire people. That's a tough mantle to take on, but you talk specifically about Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and Barack Obama and the different ways in which they took on parts of Reverend King's mantle. Can you just briefly give us a sense of the ways in which those three men chose to absorb part of the King legacy or, in some cases, perhaps had it thrust upon them?
Sure. Well, Jesse Jackson was 26 years old, 27 years old when King died and immediately became the heir apparent within several months of Dr. King's death. He gave an extraordinary interview to Playboy magazine. They called him the fiery heir apparent of Dr. King some 12, 13, 14 months later. He was able to position himself in the American imagination, also to perpetuate a legacy of a man whom the nation continued to grieve and has had to do some difficult things. Dr. King's public career lasted, 12 years perhaps. And Jesse Jackson has had to carry the load for now these last 40 years. The flaws that one makes, that one has, are more apparent. The mistakes one makes are more apparent. When you die, the sweet scent of martyrdom sweeps away all the contradictions. But yet Jesse Jackson has been the most extraordinary rhetorical genius to articulate the vision, the virtue, and the value of black life in the American public square. Al Sharpton has emerged in the last few years. Reverend Al Sharpton himself sees himself as part of the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., but at the same time, he worked up north. Dr. King worked down south. Jesse Jackson, of course, worked in Chicago. And these two gentlemen then challenged some of the prevailing forms of oppression in the midst of a northern culture that had not yet tested its commitment to civil rights, and Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton forced them to grapple with it. Jackson in Chicago, Sharpton in New York, especially focusing on police brutality and forms of white mob violence directed against vulnerable black people.
Barack Obama has a sort of different place in the the stratosphere.
He has political legitimacy in a way that neither Sharpton nor Jackson enjoyed. Jesse Jackson was the lineman who did the ugly, brutal work in the trenches of American racial warfare to open up a space for Barack Obama to be graceful and nimble as he, as a running back, so to speak, with the football, that highest prize of American political life, hopefully, people who support him believe, the presidency of the United States. So he's able to run with that goal in mind with grace and aplomb because Jesse Jackson did the heavy lifting and the brutal, nasty, bloody work. And others, to be sure. So I think that Barack Obama, of course, then has a political legitimacy that neither of those gentlemen had because he's a United States senator elected to represent a district and serve a quarter of people. And yet he's a charismatic figure as well, creating a sense of movement among the millions who now acclaim him as the best thing that happened to American politics since Jack Kennedy. So Barack Obama has claimed a unique space within the context of American political destiny and has joined the charismatic authority that attends black messianic figures who become leaders in black America, as well as the quest for political legitimacy that transcends black communities, because he's not just representing black people. He's representing white people and Latino people and Asian people. He's representing Americans. And so he's taking it to yet another level and pioneering an even different path than the one blazed by Martin Luther King Jr. or Jesse Jackson and, to a certain degree, Al Sharpton.
Well, Michael Eric Dyson, thank you.
Thank you very kindly, Farai.
Michael Eric Dyson is the author of April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America.